This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Why is it, do you suppose, that big trade deals always go by their initials? You got NAFTA, you got the TPP. We'll do it a little historical. That was then. This is now on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, April the 21st today. Great, as always, to have you along, everybody. We start today, as we are sometimes wont to do, in Washington, District of Columbia, where the Congress of the United States is nibbling away at its to-do list. At the top of that list, today anyway, was the big trade deal du jour, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Lawmakers are trying to decide whether they want to give President Obama what is called fast-track authority on the thing. Let him do the negotiating, and then Congress gets to say yay or nay, but only yay or nay. There are lots of politics involved, of course, which was apparent at hearings on the Hill today, but there is plenty of economics at play here, too, and trade deal history as well. So we asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganzer to do a little compare and contrast between the economy today and the economy the last time there was a deal this contentious on the table. That is, when NAFTA was in the offing. Here's Nancy.
It's 1993. Michael Jordan scores his 20,000th career point. Whitney Houston tops the charts. We'll always love you. And at the end of the year, President Clinton signs NAFTA into law. The U.S. is king of the global economy.
The world has changed so much from 1993.
That's Susan Ariel Aronson, a research professor of international affairs at George Washington University. Aronson says now we live in more of a multipolar world.
Brazil is the eighth largest economy in the world. Russia's economy, I believe, is shrinking, but it's still very important.
And then there's China. Catherine Dominguez teaches economics and public policy at the University of Michigan. She says China was just starting to stretch its economic legs in the early 90s. Now, well, you know.
They have obviously increased dramatically their exports all around the world. And so all eyes have been on China.
Meanwhile, back on the home front,
the U.S. share of the world economy has declined.
From about 27% in the early 90s to about 20% today, says Gary Huffbauer, a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. But Huffbauer says we still have a lot of bargaining power because the U.S. is a huge consumer market and other countries really want to sell their stuff here. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The first ever federal report card on our energy infrastructure was out today, and that includes the power grid. And I'm just going to go ahead and pluck out a few adjectives here on how the grid did. We've got aging, inefficient, congested. Need I go on? The Quadrennial Energy Review, as it's known, calls for more than $8 billion in power grid safety fixes and upgrades, including a strategic reserve for critical pieces of that grid. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that story.
The power grid is vulnerable in a couple ways, the report says. One is increasingly unpredictable weather and thus blackouts. Every year, the average New Englander loses power for 3.5 hours. The average person in Japan, 4 minutes. Threat two is physical attacks on key pieces of the grid, like high-voltage transformers.
They are critical nodes.
Engineering professor Masoud Amin at the University of Minnesota says transformers change voltage at key junctions. They're indispensable. And yet they're barely made in America.
Post-9/11, we did not have manufacturing capability to manufacture them. If they're taken out, the recovery time to actually build, deliver, retrofit, and install it was somewhere between 6 months to 2 years.
Today's report proposes a strategic transformer reserve to stockpile extra for emergencies, just like crude oil. 2 years ago, one transformer site in California was attacked by snipers. Peter Fox-Penner is with the Brattle Group Consultancy.
This was a well-trained group that had sophisticated weaponry shooting at a very critical part of the power grid.
The lights stayed on thanks to redundancies, but still.
The real fear here is that terrorists would target several transformers at once, really damage them so they couldn't be repaired.
Which could black out the country. Fox-Penner says eventually the grid may decentralize and be less vulnerable, but that would take a generation. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We did a whole bunch of stories last month about water, about how fundamentally we are not paying the actual cost of what that water is worth. That gets us to today, where California water agencies, and remember there is that whole drought thing going on out here, local water agencies are scrambling to figure out whether their water rates are legal. That's because late yesterday, a state appeals court ruled that tiered water rates in the city of San Juan Capistrano violated a California ballot proposition. Tiered water rates, those of the more you use, the more you pay variety, are a key tool in this state's campaign to save water. From our sustainability desk, once again, Marketplace's Sarah Gardner explains how California's long anti-tax pedigree is complicating water conservation.
When California voters passed Prop 218 in the mid-90s, they had no clue it might gum up efforts to conserve water in a severe drought. The idea back then was to plug what anti-tax groups saw as loopholes in Prop 13, the granddaddy of all California propositions. That one limits property taxes. 218 limits certain property-related fees from trash collection to water service. Ellen Hanick is with the Public Policy Institute of California.
Fees cannot exceed the cost of the service. And, you know, anybody who hears that will think, yeah, that sounds right. You know, why should they be allowed to charge us more than the cost of the service that they're delivering?
That's where San Juan Capistrano got into hot water. The court ruled the city's higher water rates for big water users hadn't been justified under those cost of service rules. Tim Quinn at the Association of California Water Agencies says higher water rates are commonly used to force conservation, not so much to cover costs.
If that tool is off the table, I don't know what they're going to do. It's a very powerful tool, and it's not clear to me that you'll have an easy substitute.
But water rates expert Tom Ash notes the California court did not invalidate conservation pricing. It simply clarified the rules.
I'm not afraid of any of those guidelines. I think they help us set up transparent, equitable, and very practical rates.
Still, there's already talk of possibly fixing this Prop 218 complication by simply authorizing higher water rates as penalties rather than fees. And how would you do that? Pass another proposition. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
That series, by the way, was called Water, the High Price of Cheap. It's on our homepage. Wall Street Today, one up, two down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This is not a good day to be in the egg business, especially not if you're in the top egg-producing state in this union, Iowa. More than 5 million hens there are going to be destroyed because of avian influenza, H5N2 for the pathologists among you. The outbreak has spread through a big chunk of the Midwest. And as it happens, we know a guy in the chicken business. Ed Fryer is the CEO of Ozark Mountain Poultry in Rogers, Arkansas, so we called him up to get his take. Mr. Fryer, it's good to talk to you again.
Well, it's good talking to you again.
So first of all, we should say you are a bird provider, not an egg provider, right?
That's correct.
Okay. That said, this has to be pretty scary.
It has everybody's attention. I guess when the first case hit in southern Missouri about a month and a half ago, we basically went on lockdown in terms of biosecurity. It is a scary situation.
The number is 5-something million birds that will be culled. How is that done?
The USDA goes in and does it. They have, as I understand, a big foaming machine, and they come in and foam the entire house. They cover the birds with foam, and then you dig a large pit on the farm, and you bury all of the birds in that pit and cover it back up. None of those birds are allowed to leave the farm.
When you decide, as a chicken person, that this has to be done, what are the mechanisms that you have to go through? I imagine there are public health warnings and all kinds of stuff.
Actually, we're not the ones that decide when it has to be done. USDA decides that. If we have an outbreak of anything in our house, in any one of our houses, we get in touch with USDA. We notify them. They come in. They test the birds. If it turns out that it's high path AI, which is, you know, what we're talking about right now.
High pathology aviation influenza.
That's right. Yeah. USDA comes in. They basically take control of that farm, and they'll draw about a circle with about a 6-mile radius around that, and they will shut down any movement of chickens or turkeys, whatever it happens to be, in that 6-mile radius. They'll also literally go door to door talking to individual farmers to see if they have any backyard birds or if there's any other birds out there that they've missed. If they find them, then they'll test those birds also.
Not to make it all about the consumer, but does this mean we're going to be paying more for eggs and for, you know, I mean, this is in the turkey population in Minnesota as well, so are we going to be paying more for that?
So far, the number of birds that have been affected, you see a lot of zeros, but it's small relative to the overall size of the flock that's in the United States. The U.S. will produce about 9 billion broilers this year. Not million, but billion. So it can be really tough on an individual farmer or an individual company if you lose 10 or 20 or 50 million birds, but you're still talking way less than 1% of the population.
Give me some context here. Just in your operation, how many birds a year? I know you've told me in the past.
We produce about 1.3 million birds a week.
Wow.
So where it's hurting us the most is on the dark meat.
Really?
The dollar is stronger this year than it was last year, and we export a lot of the leg quarters out of the United States. So that higher dollar makes our leg quarters more expensive relative to our competitors. So that's hurt the demand for exports to begin with. And there's a lot of countries that whenever there is high path AI in a state or in a country, they ban all imports from that country.
Everything gets back to the global economy. Ed Fryer is the CEO of Ozark Mountain Poultry. We got him in Rogers, Arkansas. Mr. Fryer, thanks again for your time, sir.
Thanks.
When you run a small business that makes stuff, the last thing you want to deal with is other people stealing your ideas, stealing your products. That's exactly what happened to Dave Munson. He is the founder and CEO of Saddleback Leather. They make higher-end leather stuff, bags and the like. But instead of suing or moping around once he got pirated, he made a video that teaches people exactly how to make his leather bags, fighting fire with fire, if you will, by putting it on YouTube and pointing out how cheap the knockoffs really are. Here's a cut.
This is actually the bottom half of the hide. This is like the genuine leather. What they do is they shave off the top half, and they sell it to people like myself, and they shave off the bottom half, and they sell it to people like you.
It's pretty clever, actually, that video was. So we called them up to chat about it. Mr. Munson, good to have you with us.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Give us, if you would, the very quick origin story of Saddleback Leather.
Okay, so in 99, I volunteered as an English teacher near Mexico City, and I needed a bag to carry my books. So I found a bag maker. He said he would make my bag if I gave him a design. So I drew it all out because I had it in my head.
Mm-hmm.
He made it. Everyone loved it and moved to Juarez and ended up sleeping on the floor with my dog for 3 years with no hot water so I could get these bags made. So all the money I saved, I would send down to this father and son team and they would make these bags and send them up to me.
They make the bags. They do really well. You start selling them and sure enough, people start knocking you off.
So people started knocking us off, and I was told it would happen. And
were you really? Did they warn you ahead of time? They were like, "Yeah, no, this is going to get stolen."
Well, actually, some customers said, "Oh, these are going to be popular," and so you just expect it. They're going to knock you off, and sure enough, they do a really good job. In fact, I ran into a guy in the airport about 3 months ago. And I said, "Hey, that's a nice bag." You know, and I thought it was my bag. And he goes,
Wait. Did you really, from afar, you thought it was actually yours?
I thought it was mine. So I walked up. I was walking toward him. I go, "Hey, that's a nice bag." And he goes, "Oh, thanks." And I really thought it was mine. And so I said to him, "So where'd you find out about Saddleback?" And he goes, "Who?"
Oh.
And I go, "Well, isn't that a Saddleback bag?" And anyway, so he said, "Well, no, I got it on eBay or something." And I said, "Oh, well, I designed it." And so, "All right, you have a nice day." And he was embarrassed, apparently. I didn't mean to embarrass him or anything. But
no,
I just,
but you get called out happened. By the guy who started the company. You're like, oh,
yeah.
Which gets us to this video that you made. What was the thought process? I mean, did you just say, you know what, the heck with these guys. I'm going to go right at them and you know, tongue firmly in cheek, help them knock me off.
I thought, hey, what if we showed people our quality? And the idea came. And then we just dogged on the people who were knocking us off. It would put doubt in everyone's mind whether or not they want to buy a knockoff or not, and it worked.
The video itself is it takes apart the making of the bag, and it talks about the leather and the materials and the workforce. What's the reaction been inside the company? Is anybody coming up to you and going, "Hey, Dave, man, don't do this. Don't tell them how to do this."
Yeah, they're like, "Why are you doing this?" And I was thinking, well, they're already knocking them off, and so rather than try to sue people and try to do all this extra work, why don't we just make fun of them and put doubt in everyone's mind about them?
Dave Munson is the founder and CEO of Saddleback Leather. We've got a link to that video on our website. It is definitely worth a couple of minutes to check it out. Dave, thanks very much for your time.
Hey, thank you.
Coming up.
I remember the attorney saying the house might be bugged, the phones might be bugged. So there was a level of, you know, paranoia.
Doing the right thing is never easy. But first, let's us do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 85 points today, 0.4%, 17,949 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ gained 19 points, 0.3%, 5,014. The S&P 500 off 3 points, 0.1%, 2,097. A big move in the generic drug industry had the markets popping a little bit. Teva Pharmaceuticals made a $40 billion bid for Mylan. The acquisition would create one of the biggest generic drug companies in the world. Mylan jumped nearly 9%. Teva rose 2% today. Good day for diapers and tissues. Shares in Kimberly-Clark, the maker of Huggies, amongst other gizmos, kicked up 5% after earnings beat expectations. Passed the Kleenex, though, to Harley-Davidson. The motorcycle company's earnings were below expectations. Shares wilted almost 10%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for March. The Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation holds a hearing titled Weathering the Storm: How Can We Better Communicate Weather to Enhance Commerce and Safety? And tomorrow is Earth Day, in honor of this orb we all live on. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Imagine for a second that you're beavering away at the office doing whatever it is that you do, and you stumble on something wrong, something distinctly not right, and you realize that your company is committing what you believe to be fraud. What do you do? The government, specifically the Securities and Exchange Commission, wants you to tell them about it. Whistleblower is the word you're looking for here. But once you do that, once you blow the whistle, then what happens? A new investigation by ProPublica tells the story of one man who knows. Tony Menendez blew the whistle on his employer, Halliburton. And then it all went wrong. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore tells his story.
In early February 2006, Tony Menendez had a very bad day.
I'm sitting at my desk. I think it was a Wednesday. I think it was mid-morning.
Menendez was working at Halliburton in the accounting department.
I got an email popped across my inbox that basically said the SEC was investigating because of me.
It was a mass email, and it was true. The SEC was investigating Halliburton because Menendez had blown the whistle on what he argued was systemic accounting fraud. But nobody was supposed to know that. Now, everyone knew.
At that point, I was really floored. You know, I felt like I was just absolutely betrayed.
Halliburton's legal department, he would find out later, had intercepted a confidential email and figured out that Tony was behind the SEC investigation. And they told everyone.
I just sat there. I didn't really know what to do. I didn't know what to. So I finally, I just grabbed my computer, grabbed my bag, and I just walked out of the building as fast as I can. Probably 3 or 4 hours, I just drove up and down the highway. I didn't really know where to go, so I just drove.
Yeah, I remember him calling and being scared and just in shock.
Andy Menendez is Tony's wife.
I remember the attorney saying the house might be bugged, the phones might be bugged. So there was a level of, you know, paranoia that was created out of it.
The irony is that Tony was actually hired to be a whistleblower, kind of. This was the era of accounting fraud, Enron, Arthur Andersen, inflated balance sheets. The guy who hired Tony in 2005 told him he wanted him to prevent and put out accounting fires.
He termed it, what he was looking for was Smokey the Bear.
Pretty quickly, he started to think that Halliburton was counting its revenue wrong, basically counting sales from contracts before the contracts were completed. It made the company look like it was making more money and more quickly than it actually was. He sent out a memo saying so.
It wasn't well received.
His boss called him in. Tony recorded the conversation.
Quite frankly, it's a good memo. Okay, and Jay and I had a lot of conversations about it, and we think that your conclusion is appropriate.
His boss said he agreed with Tony's conclusion, but he also told him he was damaging his relationships. He wasn't acting wisely. He wasn't taking into account Halliburton's special office politics, and he was making other people mistrustful of him.
And unfortunately, whistleblowers don't realize when they blow the whistle that that's what they're doing.
Eileen Taylor is a professor of accounting at North Carolina State University. She ended up writing a case study based on Tony Menendez.
Sometimes they think they're just fixing what's wrong. And they don't expect the company to react badly. They expect the company to say, thank you. Thank you for pointing this out. Let's fix it. And when the company or the management reacts negatively or calls them out or doesn't listen to them, then that's really frustrating.
After Halliburton realized that the entire company's earnings would have to be restated if Tony was right, they decided Tony was wrong.
That's when I reached out to the SEC.
And Tony says that as soon as that email went out, effectively telling everyone he had blown the whistle, everything changed for him. He wasn't invited to meetings. People wouldn't share information with him. He wasn't sent to train people. He felt like he couldn't do his job. And people at work wanted nothing to do with him.
I didn't know how the company was going to respond if I'm in the office and I'm talking to Tony.
James Paquette worked under Tony and remained friends with him even after Tony went on administrative leave.
So I changed the contact information so that if it came up on my phone, you know, and I'd sit there on the table and someone comes by and says, well, why is Tony calling you? Then I don't want to have to deal with answering those questions. I changed it to Slugger.
The SEC never spoke to Tony again after it started its investigation, and according to Tony's attorneys, it relied heavily on Halliburton to investigate itself. It ended up not filing charges, and Tony resigned. Tony filed an OSHA complaint, arguing Halliburton retaliated against him when they outed him at work. He lost. He appealed. He lost again. The judge said that being outed and ostracized was to be expected if you're a whistleblower.
It's okay to out the whistleblower without any real reason. It's okay to isolate him, ostracize, shut him out.
Tony wanted to keep fighting, but his lawyers said it wasn't worth it, and they dropped him. So he represented himself.
At that point, I had nothing else to lose.
The case bounced through the courts like a pinball. Tony almost went broke. And then, last December, a full 9 years after he blew the whistle, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled. And it sided with Tony. It awarded him $30,000, which is actually more than he asked for.
Purposely didn't ask for any money. But you have to ask for something, otherwise what's the point of, you know, most cases are about money at some level. But I only asked for $1,000.
For Tony, this case was about upholding the idea, new to whistleblowing in publicly traded companies, that outing a whistleblower could cause an employee harm, and that a public company could be held accountable for harming a whistleblower in non-tangible ways.
Yes, it has made enormous differences for whistleblowers that come after him.
James Redding was one of Tony's attorneys.
Now they know that if the company turns around and exposes them, that they have a cause of action. So I think many companies are going to take their confidential reporting systems much more seriously.
Eileen Taylor, the accounting professor who made a case study from Tony's experience, says that even though there are now more protections for whistleblowers, it's still a hard thing to do, and she wants her students to know it.
Not that they shouldn't do it, but that they need to be prepared for the reaction. It's emotionally damaging, financially damaging. And Tony succeeded, but Tony was very, very determined, and it took him years and years and years.
Tony now works at General Motors, which hired him, actually, in part because he was a whistleblower. Tony's case has been cited in other circuits where whistleblowers were awarded damages for emotional distress. But Tony doesn't gush about winning. He isn't emotional about it.
If I could go back in time and not do it, that'd probably be the smart thing. That's a hard thing to answer. It's important to do the right thing, so it's hard to say, well, it was the right thing, but if I could do it over again, I wouldn't do the right thing, you know?
In Detroit, Michigan, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Tony Menendez's story is told in an investigation by ProPublica's Jesse Eisinger that is out today. You can read the whole thing on their website or on ours. It's marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which I think that finally, just maybe, Amazon has jumped the shark. They've got a new-ish product out. It's called Home Services. It's kind of a catch-all for various and sundry things. Television wall mounting services, virus and spyware removal, plumbing, all kinds of things, as I said. Also, apparently, lawn care is in there. They've got a goat grazing service that they are offering. Here is a quote, courtesy of Kotke.org, where we saw it today, and here it is. You'll receive a recommendation for how many goats will be loaned to you, how long those goats will keep you company, and how often a pro will come and check on them. End of quote. Also, by the way, you get to keep any goat poop. It's fertilizer, you guys. The goat poop is fertilizer. All right, we're out of here. Caitlin Ash, Millie Jefferson, and Vanessa Smith are the producers on our Marketplace desks. Our digital producers are Raghu Madhavan and Tony Wagner. The senior digital producer is Nishad Kurwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.